From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Egyptian Updates with Robert Bavall. What a great program we have in store for you tonight. Here is what's happening. Northern California residents are bracing for a powerful storm that could be the biggest in 5 years, prompting the National Weather Service to issue what is called the high wind and flash flood warning. The storm will pelt the region through Thursday. It could even hit Los Angeles. It could overwhelm waterways and roadway drainage systems, possibly leading to flooding. The storm is expected to be one of the strongest storms in terms of wind and rain intensity since the October storms of 2009 and January of 2008. We did our intention experiment about a month and a half ago. Oh, maybe we did too much. With demand increasing across the West, Colorado is drawing up a strategy to keep some of the trillions of gallons of water that gushes out of the Rocky Mountains every spring, most of which flows downstream to drought-stricken California, Arizona, Nevada, Mexico. But Colorado wants to ensure that its farms, wildlife, and rapidly growing cities have enough water in the decades to come. Now, it's pledging to provide downstream states enough gallons of water that they're legally entitled to, but they say not a drop more. California, of course, was under the Colorado River Compact of 1922. It covers water allocations to Colorado, California, New Mexico, Wyoming, Utah, Arizona, and Nevada. The Coast Guard did not think that Ron Ingram could survive, stuck in a 25-foot sailboat for days as waves swelled 15 to 20 feet, but his son did. "I don't feel like he's dead," Zachary told the Coast Guard official 9 days ago after learning their search was ending. "I don't feel it." Well, he was right. Ron Ingram was picked up about 64 miles south of Honolulu, weak, hungry, dehydrated, but alive. His rescue came 12 days after he made his first distress call, a difficult stretch, even for a veteran fisherman. Let's check in with Captain Kelly Sweeney on this incredible story. I love how these ends, Kelly.
Ahoy, George. Well, there's no doubt about it. It was a Christmas miracle that his radio mayday was heard 64 miles away. He is a very lucky fisherman.
What happened to him?
Well, I think that he took on water. It wasn't quite clear from the news reports or from my sources about why he took on water. But he took on water and then had the first mayday. They sent the rescue party out, as you mentioned. They gave up because it's extremely hard to see somebody in a small boat like that out in the ocean. And they gave up, and then they happened to hear this about 9-second mayday call again, and that's what saved him.
Well, you know, Kelly, they can't find a missing Boeing huge plane. I didn't think they'd find him either.
Well, you know, George, he could have avoided this whole thing, this whole life-threatening incident, if he'd had one very small piece of equipment on board with him, a personal locator beacon. Now, a personal locator beacon is a waterproof transmitter about the size of a cell phone that connects with satellites and transmits your identification and your position to rescuers ashore in the event of an emergency.
How much do they cost?
Excuse me, George?
What do they cost?
They vary in price. $250 to $350 is about the standard range.
Jeez, that's not bad for your safety.
What's a life worth, George? I wouldn't go to sea without one. And I recommend anybody, a recreational boater, a fisherman, a professional, anyone who goes out on the water should get one for themselves for Christmas. Or if any of your listeners have a mariner on their Christmas lift, they should give them one. Because this is a gift that could save a life.
I got that. Kelly, have a great Christmas, my friend.
You too. To all your listeners, I wish you all happy holidays and smooth sailing, my friend.
Captain Kelly Sweeney, one of our dear friends. The United States has launched 20 airstrikes against Islamic State militants in recent days. Since Monday, U.S. forces conducted 7 strikes against the militant group in Syria and 13 strikes in Iraq with its partner nations. Ironically, Fox News did a study, and most Americans think ISIS may attack the United States here. More than 40% of a sample of U.S. adults believe that the flu vaccines can give you the flu, according to a new study. Let's check in with the expert on viruses, Gary Ridenour. Gary, what do you think of that? Do you think that's pretty acceptable?
Well, you know, it starts to stir up the pot of things that happened previously. October 26th, the CDC admitted that the vaccine was not effective in the elderly. The reports now is that they think it's only 50% effective to just make you feel less crampy and stuff. So the possibility of somebody saying that, you know, I got the shot and got the flu is either one, you were already incubating the flu, or two, there's something in the vaccine that activated your immune system to make you feel like you had the flu.
Some people say it's only a myth. You're not going to get sick with the flu vaccine. As you know, Gary, I don't take the flu vaccine. I don't tell people to take it or not to take it. That's their business. But I don't know. I just don't trust it.
Well, and the problem is, right, just what you just said with trust is that the World Health Organization, CDC, get together every year. They look at the common flu virus that's out there, and then by committee, they decide on what's going to be put into the vaccine. And the new vaccine, the viruses have mutated, and 52% of the viruses are not covered anymore.
All right, Gary, thank you. Appreciate that. Brazilian airliner TAM changed one of its flight numbers after a clairvoyant, a psychic, predicted a plane bearing the original number would crash shortly after takeoff. The psychic, who says he predicted the deaths of Princess Diana and a Brazilian racing legend, told authorities that the flight JJ3720, set to depart from Sao Paulo to Brazil, would develop engine trouble and crash. Leaving nothing to chance, the TAM executives changed the flight code to JJ4732. Everything worked out okay after that. Hey, did you know that the mere sight of your mobile phone can distract you even if you're not using it? According to researchers at the University of Southern Maine, they found that when people are asked to do a complicated task, they are less successful if their mobile phone is still out. Those who put it in their pocket or their bag got an average of 20% higher in the test because they were more focused. Talking about the mind, guilt, shame, and anxiety, understanding and overcoming negative emotions. Dr. Peter Breggin is next with us as we talk about that for a special 2 hours on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Peter Breggin with us, of course, Harvard-trained psychiatrist. We turn to Peter quite a bit on this program to get his expertise on various things that happen with people, their mindset, why they do what they do. He's with us for 2 hours tonight, very special 2 hours. We will take your calls. As a matter of fact, we'll probably save you about $300 an hour with Dr. Breggin. We're going to do that, Peter, and welcome back.
George, actually, I don't charge that much. Fees are a little lower. Go ahead.
I wonder if people can call you for advice and use their insurance.
It's technically done, but I don't myself do it. I try to help people right here in the Ithaca area where I can, you know, work
good
with their families if I need to, and if their kids work with their schools. So I may be international in some ways, but I'm a local when it comes to helping. This book is my attempt to be an international helper. You can't call me on the phone and get therapy, but my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, has all the wisdom I have developed over 40 or 50 years of helping people and thinking about these things to give people a sense of how they can identify the feelings that get in their way in life, how they can pigeonhole them and understand them, and then get beyond them to an emotional freedom where you can live the way you want to live. So it's ultimately a book about freedom and responsibility and how to get there.
Peter, you've written a lot of books about medication and, you know, to get people off prescribed drugs. This is an interesting one, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And I want to talk with you tonight about so many facets that are hitting people, Americans, Canadians, you name it, people listening to this program around the world tonight, that you know, things are just hitting them and bombarding them from all different angles. It is not easy to escape this emotional distress, is it?
No, it's very hard. But I like to emphasize that it's always been hard. There are no ancient books about how peaceful life was and how safe people felt. So I think it's always been difficult, but we do get bombarded much more with bad ideas and bad influences and things that make us feel anxious, especially, and guilty and ashamed. And for me, I've found, George, you know, I take on these huge drug companies. I've taken on the federal government. I take a lot of big risks, and now with my wife Ginger as a partner, we do a lot of that together. But I've found that the real-life threats aren't as frightening as the ones we carry on inside us, the painful emotions we carry around. And that as I've learned to handle those for myself and helped other people handle them, it's really clear to me that life can be handled. And it can be handled to the best of our ability, whatever it throws at us. And that should be the goal of living, because we don't know what it's going to throw at us. May give us a lot of opportunity for happiness, may give us huge amounts of stress, may provide, you know, good luck and good fortune, may not. But we can work on who we are. And one of the most fundamental things about it is to not let the external world stir up feelings of guilt, shame, and anxiety, because they're always crippling. People have people think that they're sometimes useful. You know, we need to feel ashamed. You know, guilt makes us good. Anxiety alerts us. What I try to show in the book is that if you really understand that, what's really going on inside us, how we evolve biologically, why we have these feelings. I've got a whole new theory of biological evolution, why we have these feelings. I think you'll conclude they don't help us.
No.
They may have helped inhibit us as kids, but they don't help us as adults.
Let's analyze the three areas of the book's title, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. When you talk about guilt, what do you mean by that? Give us an example.
I mean a self-punishing feeling that prevents us from doing what we want to do. So that when we want to do something, we want to assert ourselves, we want to express ourselves, there's a dreadful feeling of punishment that takes place inside ourselves. In the extreme, it makes us depressed, and we sit around and don't even know why we're depressed. We feel guilty. We don't know why we feel guilty. And in the worst outcomes, people actually injure and even kill themselves out of this self-punishing feeling. And it has no relationship to reality. People who are experiencing it think it has something to do with reality, that they've been bad or they deserve it or that life's like that. But actually, this is stuff built into our biology to control our impulses that gets stirred up in childhood before we even know what's going on. And it doesn't relate to how we should choose to live our lives. We need to choose living our lives not on feeling bad about something, but on choosing good things to pursue, taking responsibility. And I believe, you know, the whole last third of the book is about love. I believe learning to love life, love people, love nature, love God, just to take joy in the experience around us.
I was going to say, when you talk about guilt, is it something like Bernie Madoff did with his financial scam? I mean, is he in prison right now, and does he feel guilt?
No, I don't think he feels one bit of guilt. The thing about guilt, and I work, you know, do a lot of legal work, and I work with people who have committed murder and all kinds of crimes. People don't generally feel guilty about what they did. They deserve to do what they did, and they got caught. That's the problem with guilt. Now, Bernie may feel very guilty about something he deprived his mother of, or feel very guilty if he thinks about his mother or his father in some irrational way, because we all have guilt. But I don't believe that Bernie particularly probably has much guilt. He may have some shame about getting caught, some anxiety about his future. The problem is these things get built into us in a very haphazard way. By the time we're 5, 6, 7 years old, we have our patterns of guilt or our patterns of shame or our patterns of anxiety. So whether or not Bernie feels guilty really is quite haphazard. Now, can he grow as a human being, make choices, feel remorse? That is, feel I've done wrong, now I'm going to fix it. I'm going to be better. I don't know whether he can do that.
All right, let's move into shame then. What exactly is that?
Well, in shame, it's not so much that we feel that we're big and powerful, we hurt people, we're bad. You know, our mother didn't tell us, you were so big at birth, you caused me pain from the beginning. Rather, the communications we got in childhood or from school or in our culture was that we were worthless, small, insignificant, impotent, meaningless, and therefore couldn't assert ourselves. You see, it always comes down to inhibitions on assertion of oneself. And so these inhibitions make us feel powerless. The trouble is they don't work very well. And because they're primitive, built in childhood and inherited from evolution, they're primitive, they don't work so well. So when people feel a lot of load of shame, sometimes they'll finally declare in rage and anger, no, I'm not little, helpless, and impotent. I'm going to go and attack somebody and show you. And almost everybody who commits a mass murder or a personal murder of any kind or violence is feeling shame because the inhibition has broken down. So it didn't work very well. That's one of the problems with guilt and shame, too, is that they're very primitive. They don't work well. They don't work anywhere near as well as reason, love, good ideas, relationships that support our values and things like that.
And then, of course, anxiety, something that everybody has gone through, Peter. Everybody.
Yeah, well, I think everybody goes through all these things. We just don't admit them.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I mean, I hardly felt any guilt when I was little because I was so busy being good all the time. I was trying my best, but once I started to make decisions about things I wanted to do, then I realized, oh, I feel guilt all the time. So we may have a lot of guilt without knowing it. We may be so unwilling to expose ourselves to in public or to take big chances that we don't know we feel ashamed to do that. Anxiety is another thing that we all feel in every culture. It's in every culture. And it's probably, again, all these things go back millions of years in our heritage. Anxiety is where we don't have a specific identification of what's wrong. It's not like we're bad in guilt. It's not like we're worthless. It's not like we're angry at ourselves or angry at other people. Shame is an overwhelming know-nothingness, so that all of our impulses are dispersed. Ultimately, we get paralyzed. We can't make a decision. We can't think. We can't do anything. And again, it comes down to preventing us from asserting ourselves. For example, somebody who thinks about they're going to stand up to their husband or stand up to their wife, they can get an overwhelming anxiety, and it may not have to do with anything real. It may have to do with being told as a child, shut up and sit down and mind your own business.
Right.
Or, you know, you don't know where it comes from. Fear is different. Fear is specific. You know, you see a deer in the road ahead of you. I give this example in the book. You see a deer in the road, and if you have fear that alerts you, gets your adrenaline pumping, and you think to yourself, okay, don't swerve the car. I'm going to do what they say on the radio, stay on the roads, better to hit the deer, slow down. And that's your thinking. But if you get anxious and you feel like, oh, my God, what's happening to me, which is what anxiety is, I'm doomed. What am I going to do? I'm helpless. What am I going to do? Well, you slam on your brakes, you swerve the car, God knows what you do. So it's fear is different. Fear is the alerting system that's useful. Guilt, shame, and anxiety are demoralizing. They're demoralizing. I call them negative legacy emotions. It's actually a new theory of negative legacy emotions. We get these emotions as legacies from evolution, from childhood, from church, from school. Some of our political leaders try to make us feel guilty, ashamed, and anxious about who we are.
These
get them from all different directions.
These three areas, Peter, guilt, shame, anxiety. I want to ask you when we come back from the break if we create it or if others do it to us. Stay with us. Dr. Peter Breggin with us. His latest work is called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and it's available, of course, all over the place. And his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back, and we'll talk more with him. He's also got three steps to what he calls emotional freedom. How about that? We'll be back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Peter Breggin with us. Peter, guilt, shame, anxiety, do we create it or do other people do it to us?
It's a combination of both. It's in our genes. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in every culture everywhere since time began. So it's in our genes. It's in our genes as much as the ability to speak and as much as the, I think, hunger and sex. It's really built into us to respond that way. When we're children, two cues that we get from the environment. But then we are very busy, even as children, thinking about things, and we can pursue our own avenues of making ourselves feel guilty, ashamed, and anxious, because we're not just, you know, box the mechanical boxes. So I think it's a combination, what we're given the capacity, childhood, especially if it's neglectful or abusive, or we've got some real trauma and losses. Childhood then enforces various patterns, but we also make our own choices about it. And then as we get older, you know, siblings and peers inflict huge amounts of shame on boys and girls that end up inhibiting them terribly.
Sure.
Being bullied enforces it. A lot of religious experiences in childhood make kids feel guilty and ashamed and anxious. You know, they're anxious about hell. They're ashamed about their bad, quote, bad feelings. They feel guilty. So the influences come from all around us, and there aren't a lot of people, except some of the, you know, really good-thinking folks, telling us that actually you can let go of your guilt, shame, and anxiety, and you can live a loving, even heroic life if you want, because what holds us back ultimately are those built-in feelings that come from within us, from history as animals, and also from our culture. But we really can get past them. I really found that, George, and I actually started working on this book is like 40 or 50 years in the making. Unlike any other
book. You're kidding me. You know, in all the years you've been talking with us, Peter, you never hinted that you were working on this.
Well, that's it. Well, you know, I think I've always thought my main task in life was to take on psychiatry, the drug companies, the government. And now I'm realizing in my older years what gave me that capacity. And also, what do I do as a therapist that's helpful? What do we all do for each other that's helpful? So I've been just thinking about these things a very long time. I have charts in the book about how to identify guilt, shame, and anxiety in yourself and then what to do about it that I began sketching out in the era I call before Ginger, which is more than 30 years ago, about 35 years ago. I have charts that had 2,000 items in them from all the years about looking for anxiety in yourself, identifying and overcoming it, that I've winnowed down for the book. So I've been thinking about this for a very, very long time, and I think it's one of the reasons why I've been able to do what I do with my life, and it's certainly one of the reasons why I've been able to finally, you know, have a really loving relationship.
Well, you're a fun, loving person. I mean, you have a heart of gold, and you're always upbeat. Negativity. I try to stay away from people who are negative. They're Debbie Downers, and you know, there are some of them, Peter, they're great people. They're nice people. I like them as people. But they're so negative about everything, you just want to get away. What do you tell those kinds of people? I mean, what do you do to help them?
Well, I think the first thing you do is you help yourself.
By running out the door.
Running out the door. You protect yourself first. Unless it's your child and you're indebted, you're responsible for their lives, or they're a friend or somebody who's really has a relationship where you have been given a great deal, unless it's a meaningful relationship, and even in those, it's very important. It's one of the most important principles in the book is the unconditional right to emotional self-defense, or I also call it the inalienable right to emotional self-defense. And life gets much better when you decide that you will always be treated with respect and hopefully will with love. And if you greet people and you learn to do this, you got to learn this and practice it. If you greet everybody from, you know, the waitress and the bus driver and the person who's giving you a ticket at the meter, and then your clients, your friends, in your case, you know, the how wonderfully you treat your audience and me, George, you treat me wonderfully. If you more and more decide you want to treat people wonderfully and you want them to treat you that way too, and you don't accept not being respected and when appropriate, loved, it's very, very important. And if my listeners now are thinking, if you who are listening to me are thinking, wow, if I related like that, I wouldn't have any of my friends. Well, maybe that's the case.
Maybe you need to change.
But it won't be for long. Because once you decide you're going to be loving and respectful and expected, you will meet new people because there are others who want that kind of life.
About a month ago, after the show, I went home and was up. Couldn't get to sleep. So I was watching Amazon Video, and I was watching the movie. It was a movie about Ted Bundy, the serial killer. I've been fascinated with that case since I was a reporter back in the early 70s. And I this was a movie about him, but the actor did a great job. And, I mean, he portrayed the guy probably realistically. With no emotion, no guilt, just he could kill people, he could kill women, and just not have any feelings about it. What's wrong with somebody like that, Peter? I mean, as a psychiatrist, if Bundy came in and said, I need help, how in the heck would you even start?
Well, he doesn't come and ask for help. He takes it out on other people. I think a good definition of evil is taking out your painful emotions on other people. He's probably not feeling much guilt because he probably didn't have the kind of connections in early childhood that made him feel he had the power to even be bad. He probably, and this is very speculative, but I have worked with so many people and I've studied so many mass murderers, he most likely is shame-driven. He was probably made to feel little and worthless. Maybe he attributes it to women, that women did this to him. People can get very screwed up. Your father can do it to you, but you blame it on your mother because of the manipulation you go through. But he came out of childhood probably with feelings in relation to women of shame,
yeah.
And they were so overwhelming, he just reacted back by saying, I'll show you. I have the power. I have the control. It's about power. And the reason a person goes so much for power is they feel powerless. And we all have some of that in us. You know, we can all get shamed enough so that we want to hurt somebody. And the book helps you identify that more natural level of shame and shows you how to just let that go, identify it, let it go, decide it is unreal. It's just an emotion built in. And you then can decide how you want to relate to people. And it's always better, when at all possible, to relate through, you know, reason and love, providing you're also protecting yourself, providing you're protecting yourself emotionally.
People who are sociopaths, Peter, same mold?
Well, I think that's what you're talking about. You're talking about, yes, people who for whatever reason in childhood, there's no evidence this is genetic, George. The evidence is we're all built with the same stuff. We're all built to respond with guilt, shame, and anxiety.
Yeah,
but
we should.
Horrible enough trauma in childhood or neglect or being unloved can really warp us so that we just become dominated by one emotion. And almost all people who take advantage of others, hurt others, are being driven by shame. When I hurt somebody or hurt their feelings, it's almost always that my feelings have been hurt and I'm feeling ashamed. I'm not dealing with it, So I'm just not being nice in return. We actually can do without these emotions. That's one of the things I really want to communicate to folks. People think, well, I'm a good person because I feel guilty. I felt that the first 30 years of my life, I think. I feel guilty, so therefore I am good. You feel guilty because you've been hurt, not because you're good. Love is what enables us and reason to be truly useful and good to other people.
There's an old saying. I don't want to interrupt you here, but it goes, of all things said, of tongue and pen, the saddest of which what might have been. When you do something stupid that you feel guilty about, you really can't go back and change it. But how do you move forward so you don't do it again?
Well, I think understanding that this actually has very little to do with reality, and somebody else down the block is doing the same thing and thinking it's funny as all heck, or somebody else down the block has done something 10 times worse and feels no guilt at all. I think it's just so important to realize that all these negative feelings we get are very simple-minded. They're just built-in stuff from childhood. They're simple-minded. And if you get that straight, you can sort of set it aside and say, I don't need you. I'm not going to feed you. I'm not going to obey you. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to think, what's the way I want to behave? How do I want to be? How do I want to conduct myself? And if you can set your shame and guilt aside, you can actually be a better, more loving, more caring, more rational, more giving human being. Your guilt and shame and anxiety are just keeping you from that other side we have, which is our deep social loving nature. And a part of what the book is about is this war in us between our loving nature and our violent nature. My new evolutionary theory is that guilt, shame, and anxiety evolved, George, for survival, because we're so violent and so loving at the same time, we would have just torn ourselves apart and our families going back millions of years. So nature favored those of us who would feel guilt, shame, and anxiety when we got expressive and assertive and certainly violent within the family, not within other people. I mean, geez, we just go about and do things to other people, other nations, other races, and so on, with almost impunity. And I think we need to just look and say, okay, that may have worked when we were primitive, but it doesn't work for mature adult decision-making. Adult decision-making is always best served by ethics and love, thinking things through, opening your heart. And I define love in the book as joyful awareness. And that's very important. Love isn't slavery. Love isn't being abused. Love is a joyful awareness we bring to life, to our children, wives, husbands, work, professions, art, appreciating nature and music, joyful awareness. I think that that is the most healing and important aspect of our lives. Even while we choose to do things that won't necessarily always bring that, I mean, we all, if we're honorable and ethical, we choose to do things that don't always leave us, happy and joyful, but that the most essential quality we have for our sanity is joyful awareness.
Peter, the person who doesn't have the guilt, the shame, or the anxiety, or shows it, they grow up to be what? Presidents? Politicians? Who are these people?
Well, I think that it's a power question. The unfortunate truth is that in every arena of life, power rises to the top, and not necessarily intelligence, but the ability to manipulate power, which can be shrewdness and coyness. And that comes out of, I think, feeling worthless and shameful. So I think if you scratched a lot of people who get to the top, you're going to find a lot of people who felt so worthless that they sacrificed everything to get to the top. It doesn't bring happiness. You know, in my life, all the various successes have not brought the happiness that a loving relationship brings. And so certainly, I'm sure, in my I like most people, you know, who are successful, was somewhat driven by feelings of not being successful. But you want to be able to let that go in your own personal life and realize that whatever power you've been striving for, it isn't probably going to end up really helping people because you're just getting power over them. And it isn't a route to happiness. Happiness, I think, comes from personal relationships that are equalitarian, responsible, respectful. So I imagine that a lot of politicians and very successful people and I can be pretty unhappy if they've gotten there through power rather than through giving gifts to humanity.
That's true. What is your definition, Peter, of love?
Joyful awareness. I've never heard anyone else quite use it. Two words, joyful awareness. So if you look in the eyes of your loved one, and she or he makes you happy, joyful, and that then produces a desire to nurture and care for. And you can feel that for the loved one, with many of us, especially people who have been injured in their relationships, feel it more toward their animals. I feel it toward my gardens. I love them and I nurture them. And you know, it's like any relationship, I get angry at how they grow and the weeds come in. By the way, a metaphor I use in the book that I think is helpful is to think of your mind as a garden. There really are weeds in it. And you didn't even plant them all, just like you don't plant the weeds in your garden.
Get that herbicide.
Well, the psychiatry gives you the herbicide. It doesn't work. You got to consciously weed your garden and consciously plant wonderful new ideas and emotions. And we can do this. I know we can. And I help people do it. And I want the book to do that. The book's in three parts, just to orient people. The first part is this theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time anybody's done this. This is new. The first time anybody's had a comprehensive theory that covered guilt, shame, and anxiety and how it evolved. And I kind of hinted about what that is. The second part is this very practical section on identifying guilt, shame, and anxiety, learning to say no to them, learning to replace them with much better ideas. I literally have charts and diagrams to help you do that. And I deal with all, you know, many hundreds of problems people have given me in regard to how is it possible to do anything like that. And then the final third of the book, and it's divided in thirds, is about love. Because I really do believe that we're given the capacity to love, not just by evolution, but by someone higher, greater, more powerful, more understanding. And I don't know whether God is anything like a human or a person. I do feel that this world is engendered, is given, infused with not just all this other stuff, but with love. And there's love and there's all this other stuff. We want to get as much as we can to having loving relationships. And I just know that you basically think that way, George. I just hear it all the time in what you say.
Oh, absolutely. Peter, we're going to come back in a moment and take some phone calls with you. Here's your opportunity to talk to a genuine psychiatrist. Questions, stories, you name it, we've got it for you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.